Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Bruin podcast. In this edition, we're going to be talking about China with none other than Diana Choi Laver, the chief economist of Inodo Economics. We're going to talk about everything related to China, with the exception of the big news at the moment, the coronavirus, because it's just such an unfolding story. And we thought it would be more useful to have this as a sort of benchmark of how we're feeling about China going into 2020. So as a teaser of what's to come up, we have the following comment from Diana.
It's not gone into the technical recession that our numbers, let's say, showed during the global financial crisis, but nevertheless has been also progressive slowdown through the year to numbers which are certainly worrying the authorities.
So to get more details on how the Chinese economy is performing and is expected to perform, stay tuned after the following messages.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Bruin podcast. The year starts with China very much in the news, and so we're very lucky to have with us Diana Choi Laver, chief economist of Inodo Economics, the premier research house looking at all things Chinese. So thanks very much for joining us, Diana.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, good, good. Well, just starting in terms of, I guess, you know, what is going on in China. According to the official figures, we saw growth obviously slowing last year to a bit more than 6%. Clearly, the slowest pace since the early 90s, but it doesn't sort of sound too bad. But I mean, what's one of the things that we get from your writing is, I guess, confirmation of our suspicions that these numbers aren't really telling you the full story of what's going on in China, which had some real troubles with the trade war and stuff last year. So can you just give us a sort of update of how the Chinese economy was really performing during that time and where it is now?
Absolutely. You're right. You know, dealing with the Chinese data is so hard. It's unreliable for a variety of reasons. And if you just look at the headline numbers, you don't really get the real picture. You always have to dig deeper. I say that you have to pretty much try and collect as much raw information as possible. Know what these pieces of the puzzle really are, because sometimes they call them one thing and they actually mean another, and then try and put them into the same coherent picture. And the more pieces you manage to put, the more confident you get that you have the right story. And more often than not, because actually China does produce a lot of data, you sort of get a sense where you have a good conviction. And, right. You know, doing that exercise, what's clear to me is that over the course of last year, growth weakened. And it weakened to more than 6%. I mean, we've been calculating our own GDP data for 13 years, taking entirely the official data, by the way, but it just showed us over the years how much they smooth the cycle.
So you're using official sources, but without this smoothing.
Yeah, so basically it's like a cross-check on what they're doing, because they keep it a secret, but generally they say that they take the nominal GDP data and then deflate it by using a deflator and arrive at the real numbers. So what we do is take their published nominal GDP data, we seasonally adjust it, and we create a deflator out of the range of official price data that they publish. Now, we don't know if they use it or create it exactly like we do. But yeah, often what we see is that they would have to have had an entirely different set of official price data that they're using for their deflator you know, by comparing the two, if you
so
see what I
mean. The nominal data is the same sources that you're using, but it's the costs that are
And
that
the
are
costs
difference.
Are theirs yeah. entirely, but it's just how we combine them in the deflator. We don't know exactly how they combine them. But often the disparity between what we see and what they publish is so large that really, I mean, they must have had an entirely different set of price data that they have used. Otherwise, what they've officially published doesn't match up.
Okay, so you just said that Chinese growth slowed by more than 6%. So just clarify that. What rate
on
do
our
you think
numbers?
It's slowed
to, and I would say really, just at the moment, looking at the first three quarters of the year, and I will tell you what's the problem with Q4. It's about 4%.
Right.
So it's not gone into the technical recession that our numbers, let's say, showed during the global financial crisis, but nevertheless has been also progressive slowdown through the year to numbers which are certainly worrying the authorities.
Yeah. So are we seeing that growth rate picking up now, or is it still sort of anchored down there?
Well, they published the Q4 numbers last week.
Yeah.
And they did that on Friday. And then very sneakily published a set of updates to back data over the weekend, which wasn't advertised anywhere, as we can see on the National Bureau of Statistics website in Chinese.
I'm going to admit I missed it.
Well, I mean, you would have. We caught it because we have been dealing with this stuff for years and we have created sort of all the checks and balances. And in fact, I was saying to Salma this morning, my colleague, that I am about to write a note about this in greater detail to show you guys how much work we do behind the scenes, because it really was like a life in the China detective, a day in the life of the China detective. So let me leave the Q4 numbers to the side, because really a total mess, which we're investigating at the moment, whether they did it on purpose or didn't, I don't want to comment. If we look at the overall picture, it looks like there was some improvement in Q4, but not a dramatic improvement.
Right.
So what we expect over the course of this year is that the authorities will be getting going on trying to get stabilized growth, but essentially they wouldn't quite like it at 3-4%, I wouldn't say, and try and boost it a bit more. And the big question really is, will they be able to do so?
So for us less sophisticated China watchers, we saw that pick up in industrial production numbers in December. Can we take that at face value, or are you saying we need to wait until you've done more diligent work?
These are the bits of the pieces that I was saying contribute to the expectation that there was a pickup.
Right.
It just doesn't appear to be a dramatic pickup.
Yeah.
It's not sort of a doubling of growth to 8%.
No, no.
And so there is some pickup, but because, if you'd like, I'm starting from a much lower growth rate, which I think is the reality. And I do think the Chinese authorities realize the realities as well. I mean, even Li Keqiang at the time said, oh, I totally ignore the GDP figures. I look at what people then termed the Li Keqiang index. So
yeah.
I think that they are very clear on the situation. And actually that, I'm sure we'll talk about the trade war. It has had bearings
on
what happened now at the sort of signing of the phase one deal. So yes, there is improvement. Yes, there is more stimulus. It's going to be the old style stimulus. They're really sort of going again for credit-driven investment-led growth. Investment didn't perform at all as well as they wanted it last year. So we'll see more push on that front. We expect some success, but this year is also the year where they really have to sort out the bad debt mess. And that's going to be deflationary. So we don't expect that their stimulus efforts will produce more than, at best, stabilization of growth around the levels that I was talking about.
Okay, well, let's talk about that then, the sort of the much heralded kind of reform of the Chinese financial system then. I mean, you've been careful to kind of dampen our expectations about how much President Xi wants to reform the Chinese economy. Should we still be skeptical about these things happening? I know it encompasses a lot of things like opening the financial system and also dealing with bad debts and stuff like that. But you know, what should our expectations be?
I think you have to start from understanding that when the Chinese talk about reform, they mean very different things to the sort of definition or expectations we have in the West. Mm. So much so that I sort of stopped using the word reform because I think I convey the wrong impression depending on who I'm talking to.
Okay.
And so I sort of use supply side transformation and change. Now, what they realized is that they couldn't just throw money at growth anymore. You know, structurally, the growth rate had come down. So if they just threw money, they got into inflation, what they think is sort of speculation in terms of the housing market, and that caused social unrest and blah, blah, blah. So they have genuinely, since 2015-16, tried to change structurally various things, not in the way at all that, let's say, we in the West might advise them to do in our market economy models or ways of thinking at or looking at the economy. But nevertheless, they've done types of reforms that are addressing certain inefficiencies in their system. For example, when we're talking about the financial system, we've had the benchmark lending rate changed towards something that's a bit more market determined. You know, in China, SOEs borrow primarily from the banks, and the private businesses had to borrow at much, much higher rates in the shadow banking economy. Now, there is this push for the last few years that the banking system provides the loans to the private SMEs. Now, lots of issues with that, whether they manage to do or not, but it's a push in the right direction. But at the same time, they're not touching the deposit rate. They're not going to make that market sort of driven anytime soon, they've told us. Or for that matter, the housing, the mortgage rate for now. I think the mortgage lending rate, they expect to move in about 2-3 years. But for the deposit rate, they're saying it's not in the foreseeable future. So what that is doing is producing still the distortions from a market perspective that households get financially repressed. So it's again all, you know, yes, this time it's a little bit of inefficiency removed because the private companies will in theory be able to borrow at cheaper rates from banks rather than shadow banks. But it's again at the expense of the household sector that will see this sort of non-existent returns on 2/3 of household financial assets in China are in interest-bearing deposits, which have earned practically nothing for years and years. And the shadow banking explosion, on the one hand, was risky. And, you know, when they talk about it in terms of risk, yes, it's a good thing to bring it back on banks' balance sheets, but they also are doing it because they want the control. And the result of this is that the households used to get higher yields in wealth management products and maybe the P2P lending products. And then when they started working, constraining the wealth management products, they moved to structured deposits, which now they're clamping down as well. So again, essentially the financial repression of the household sector is continuing. And that's why they have to yet again, even though reluctantly, throw money at investment and infrastructure investment, which it has been actually quite extraordinary how restrained they were in 2019, not wanting to do yet a bigger, big stimulus. So financial change, opening up the financial system, again, very beneficial for them. It's the right step, but kind of motivated by their semi-command communist political system reasoning rather than our market economics perceptions. And that we have to be very clear when we analyze China about that in order to then make sense of how to invest in it.
So you mentioned the trade deal earlier and the phase one agreement that's been reached. And part of one of the conditions of that is to allow more opening up of the financial system to US banks. So how is that going? What's the impact of that going to be on the economy?
So for China, it's in its interest, really, to open up its financial system. Yeah. They feel that at this stage, their banks are big enough, the big four are probably strong enough. They have massive problems in the smaller lenders, and it's probably we're going to see massive recapitalization, merger and acquisition activity going on. This will be the cleanup of the next 2 years. They're leaders in the mobile payments, you know, so they feel pretty strong on a lot of fronts to open the doors. And why it's in their interest outside of sort of the usual thing of getting know-how. I mean, I've been advising the Chinese fund managers, domestic fund managers, since 2009. They've certainly become much more sophisticated in the 10 years I've been working closely with them. But, you know, oh my God, at the start of it all, even 2009, I mean, they really didn't have much experience. So there's more to learn there. But the big issue is that China now has a tiny, tiny current account surplus. Again, the full year data we'll get in about a month's time. I think it was 14th of February, I remember, because, of course, it's Valentine's Day.
Yes.
Although, actually, in my case, it's when we'll get all the sort of letters for the 11 plus, because my older son is getting into that. So, it's like, so on a lot of levels, I remember that it's the 14th of February. So we'll
busy
get...
day, yeah.
I know. We'll see that picture then, but as it is now, and actually our expectation is that if they manage to get this investment sort of surge, they'll probably even go into a deficit. And then they just signed a phase one trade deal where they're going to be abstaining from competitive devaluation. So, yes, they have foreign exchange reserves, but let's say if the market pushes to for a weaker currency, I mean, they have to have the capital inflows to match or outweigh for the currency to appreciate. And if those are not forthcoming, then the exchange rate will have to move. And it's a bit perverse that, I mean, in some ways, the best thing would have been if the Chinese were opened up their capital account fully and they allowed the market to determine the exchange rate. But yet again, they're doing halfway house. They're allowing foreign money to go in. In fact, they're really keen on it. But they're not allowing domestic money to go out as and when and how it wishes.
And is that because they're worried about being able to keep the yuan stable?
Partly, yes, absolutely. And also, in the system they have politically, in a way, capital outflows are like a vote of no confidence in the authorities. We are not doing things right. You know, money's leaving. It's not staying. So that's partly as well why Xi Jinping really tightened. Of course, the drama of 2015 and early 2016 was the trigger for it. But really, the fundamental fear is also always how does that impact the Communist Party politically? You know, do people have faith and belief in us?
People cite the impact on the banks. If you were to have a lot of money leaving the Chinese economy, then it potentially destabilizes the banks. Is that realistic or is that a bit over the top?
So what I would argue is that any marketization, you know, if you were moving from a command economy to a market economy, even if that's just in one aspect, you know, now this thing is regulated, now it's going to be opened up. There is always disruption. It can never happen smoothly. It's what you have to assess is how long the disruption is going to be, and are afterwards the gains going to more than outweigh this in a reasonable period of time if you're a policymaker, or is the potential for disruption going to be such that, you know, you could really collapse the system, and how should you deal with that?
Yeah.
So it's a very, very difficult decision, which China actually observed the whole difficulty of first the Soviet Union moving as well, and what happened there with Big Bang. And so absolutely, I agree that totally liberalizing is going to be disruptive and difficult, but that I think that ultimately it will produce the right incentives in the economy to make them grow sustainably. And grow in a way that's beneficial for, obviously, their own population, but also for the rest of the world. Because China is 1.4 billion people. It's gigantic. just entirely trying to rise up the value-added chain and have export-led growth, it's not possible because the rest of us are not sort of that many or big enough to...
Can't buy enough.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And then it creates all sort of distortions in the global economy that have far-reaching political and economic impact.
Which brings us, I guess, onto the trade war then. So, I mean, you were way out in front of everybody else on this in terms of recognising the scale that it would reach, and then again in terms of recognising how it would transition to technology in particular. So have we seen the back of trade as the sort of frontier with this? Is that whole situation going to be de-escalated in terms as the point of contention moves on to technology, or are they both going to remain an issue?
So what I think, and this is much more from Trump's side, and I'm not saying America's side, because there are different stakeholders in America and different sort of forces pulling different levers. But we have the US election in November this year, and it seems to me that on Trump's side, he just signed his phase one deal. It's not a great deal. I mean, China basically agreed to lots of things that are actually as well in its own favor. And what is the surprising bit to me of the phase one deal was that they actually agreed to sign it with the tariffs still hanging over their head. That's the surprising bit. And the tariffs being used as enforcement. Because what that told me, and I don't know if, I don't think that's necessarily how most other analysts looked at it, but it told me that Xi Jinping is actually in a much stronger political position than I realized, because he would have never agreed to what appears like imperialist pressure. That would have been, if he was feeling uncertain domestically, that would have been used against him. But at the same time, the fact that he agreed to something that is, you know, the one thing that they didn't want to do in this deal, suggests to me that they're more worried about growth than it shows on the surface.
Sure.
They're more worried about that structural change, all the pain they have to go through and trying to sort things out.
So it could imply he's politically stronger, or that perhaps they're economically weaker than it
yes,
seems. And you think it might be a bit of both then, do you?
I think it's... both, yes.
Right.
I think it is actually him in a very strong political position, really no viable opposition internally. Of course, you know, it's such a black box that, but that's the conclusion I will draw. But them worrying that they have sort of important things to crack on with, and that trade war was not helpful. And they did realize, of course, the severity of how this could move. But what we need to realize here is that it's the Chinese who started the great decoupling, as we call it. They want to become self-sufficient in their sphere of influence. It's not that this divergence in the world started with Trump's arrival. No, it started much more with the Chinese feeling that they caught up, they learned a lot from the West, which actually they surprised themselves at the speed of improvement, especially with technology. And they sort of realized that now they can push faster and stand up, you know, taller and announce their aim, which their aim, they very clearly stated, we don't want to follow your model, we want to follow our own model. They're ambiguous about whether they want to offer their model to us or they're fine with us having our model. So that they're keeping
right.
that ambiguous. And, of course, there's a whole new discussion that I'm
yeah.
trying to speed up and be more to the point. And so what I see on the trade war is that they don't want to foment that at this point. Trump probably doesn't want to foment that at this point. But all the other aspects of the Great Decoupling are going to intensify, and in particular, the tech. And of course, here domestically in the UK, we are about to announce whether and how we will deal with Huawei. But essentially, the US has made its position very clear on that front. And ultimately, who wins the global geopolitical race will depend on who wins the global technology race.
Okay, and in terms of, so with that background, we saw the end of last year, quite a strong one for the yuan, for the renminbi, quite a strong one for the Chinese markets. Do you think there's further to go with that sort of that recovery, or should we be more cautious?
I'd say more cautious, because we need to see the confluence of, first of all, what happens on the current account. You know, what has happened is that the savings rate has gone down in China over the last few years for good reasons and bad reasons. And the investment rate, though, didn't go down as fast. So that ate the current account surplus. Now, if they're going to try and boost the investment, my expectation is that the investment rate will be going up. What is more difficult to assess, not least because the savings rate data tends to be so outdated, but we have some survey data, the household sector savings rate is probably going up. That's what the survey data tells us. That's what actually we would expect given various developments. Businesses, though, are doing pretty badly. So ultimately business savings is really their EBITDA. So we see that either flat or down, and then the government will be stimulating, so we see that down. So on balance, we expect the savings rate to stay either stable or go down and the investment rate to be going up. So we think it's going to be a current account deficit. Then what happens with capital wars? I mean, we tend we've split the great decoupling is split in the trade war, tech war, and Taiwan war.
Yes.
The Taiwan war just signifies military confrontation. We just like the TTT. The trade war is the same way. We have put in that also the capital markets war.
Yeah.
So I would say they reached a trade deal and China is opening up its financial market. But what happens with all the initiatives and all the sort of careful consideration that the US is now putting on whether they should be financing and opening their capital markets and allowing the Chinese to list, or whether they should be delisting them because they're not complying with the local regulations and all of that. So that side of the, which I would put under our trade war definition, but it can get confusing. So the capital war, I think, will intensify. And there will be issues of tension there. So will that, I mean, the Chinese were very, very, the strategy was, let's get our assets in the indices. That will get the passive money in. Then we'll sort of stimulate it using our state-owned measures, you know.
To bring capital into the economy.
To then entice the active managers. Because, the active managers, up until the time when the Chinese assets were in the indices, they could say, okay, my view is on China, I don't want to sort of mess around with it, I don't understand it, I don't have to invest, I'm going to do this. They didn't have to explain to the owners of assets why. Now it's in the index, they have to make a decision, do I actually not follow that index because China is in it? If I follow it, am I underweight, overweight? And you have to have an explanation. And of course, you know in your position as well that, you know, you can have a 1 to 3 year outlook and an investment strategy. But if 1 quarter, 2 quarter, 3 quarter, 1 year is going against you, it gets harder. So if you remember, the Chinese equity market started the best performing market last year. And if that had gone and the May dissolution of the, if the May deal was signed and not went on to phase one November, then I think that could have carried on and the active money would have gone in. And that got disrupted by the prolonging of the friction. And sort of in that time also, I think investors, when you were right, when we started talking about this and, you know, guys anticipate this is going to be the major force in markets, we got a lot of blank faces. And sort of pushback, and even seasoned investors a year and a half ago said, oh, that's a storm in a teacup, it's not gonna matter. But now that has changed.
I guess that really emphasizes the importance of staying on top of these very, very complicated issues. Well, I think that's probably all we've got time for on this podcast. So, Diana, thank you so much for taking us through all that. And thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. We hope you'll join us again on the next Brewing Podcast. Thank you.